Antenna track direct front, a Bradley commander called from 400 meters to the colonel's right. Range 2K meters, moving in now. The lawyer officer lifted his head above the abbreviated ridge and scanned the field with his thermal viewer. Now was as good a time as any. Hoot Owl, this is 6. Party in 10, I say again, party in 10 seconds. 4-3, stand by. 4-3 is standing by, 6. That Bradley would take the first shot in second of KKMC. The gunner selected high-explosive incendiary tracer. A Burdum wasn't tough enough to need the armor-piercing rounds he had in the dual-feed magazine of his Bushmaster cannon. He centered the target in his pipper, and the onboard computer adjusted for the range. "Eat shit and die," the gunner said into the interphones. "Hoot Owl 6, commence firing, commence firing." "Fire," the track commander told the gunner. The Spec 4 on the 25mm gun depressed the triggers for a 3-round burst. All 3 tracers made a line across the desert, and all 3 hit. The command Burdum erupted into a fireball as the vehicle's gas tank, strangely for a Russian-made vehicle, it was not diesel-powered, exploded. "Target," the commander said instantly, confirming that the gunner had destroyed it. "Traverse left, target Burdum." "Identified," the gunner said when he was locked on. "Fire." A second later, "Target, cease fire, traverse right, target Burdum. 2 o'clock, range 1500. The Bradley's gun turret rotated the other way as the enemy vehicles started to react. "Identified. Fire." And the third one was dead 10 seconds after the first. Within a minute, all the Burdums the screen commander had seen were burning. The brilliant white light made him cringe to see. Then other flashes appeared left and right of his position. Then, "Move out, run 'em down." Across 10 miles of desert, 20 Bradleys darted from behind their hiding places, going forward, not backward, their turrets traversing and their gunners hunting for enemy scout vehicles. A short, vicious, running gunfight began, lasting 10 minutes and 3 clicks, with the Burdums trying to pull back, but unable to shoot back effectively. 2 Sager anti-tank missiles were launched, but both fell short and exploded in the sand when their launch vehicles were killed by Bushmaster fire. Their heavy machine guns weren't powerful enough to punch through the Bradley's frontal armor. The enemy screen, comprising a total of 30 vehicles, was exterminated by the end of it, and Hoot Owl owned this part of the battlefield. "Wolfpack, this is Hoot 6 Actual. I think we got 'em all. Their lead screen is toast. No casualties," he added. God damn, he thought, those Bradleys can shoot. "Some radio chatter got out, sir," the Alint trooper next to Eddington reported. "Getting some more now." "He's calling for artillery fire," a Saudi intelligence officer said quickly. "Hoot, you may expect some fire shortly," Eddington warned. "Roger, understand. Hoot is moving forward." It was safer than staying in place or falling back. On command, the Bradleys and Hummers darted 2 clicks to the north, looking for the enemy supplementary reconnaissance screen. There had to be some, which would move up now, probably cautiously, on direction of their brigade or divisional commanders. This, the guard lieutenant colonel knew, would be the reconnaissance battle, the undercard for the main event, with the lightweights duking it out before the heavyweights closed. But there was a difference. He could continue to shape the battlefield for Wolfpack. He expected to find another company of reconnaissance vehicles, closely followed by a heavy advanced guard of tanks and BMPs. The Bradley had tow missiles to do the tanks, and the Bushmaster had been designed for the express purpose of killing the infantry carrier they called the BIMP. Moreover, though the enemy now knew where the Blue Force recon screen was, had been, he would expect it to fall back, not advance. That was plain 2 minutes later, when a planned fire barrage dropped a click behind the moving Bradleys. The other side was playing it by the book, the old Soviet book. And it wasn't a bad book, but the Americans had read it too. Hoot Owl pressed on rapidly for another click and stopped, finding a convenient line of low ridges, with blobs on the horizon again. The lawyer, Colonel, lifted his radio to report that. "Buford, this is Wolfpack. We are in contact, sir," Eddington relayed to Diggs from his CP. "We just clobbered their recon element. Our screening forces now have visual on the advance guard. My intentions are to engage briefly and to pull them back and right southeast. We have enemy artillery fire dropping between the screen and the main body. Over.
Roger, Wolfpack.
On his command screen, Dig saw the advancing Bradleys, moving in a fairly even line but well spread. Then they started spotting movement. The things they saw started appearing as unknown enemy symbols on the IVUS command system. It was immensely frustrating to the general in command. He had more knowledge of a developing battle than had ever been possible in the history of warfare. He had the ability now to tell platoons what to do, where to go, whom to shoot. But he couldn't allow himself to do that. He'd approved the intentions of Eddington, Ham, and Magruder, coordinating their plans in space and time. And now, as their commander, he had to let them do it their way, interfering only if something went wrong or some new and unexpected situation offered itself. The commander of American forces in the kingdom, he was now a spectator. The black general shook his head in wonderment. He'd known it would be like this. He hadn't known how hard it would hit him. It was almost time. Ham had his squadrons advancing abreast, covering only 10 kilometers each, but separated by intervals of 10 more. In every case, the squadron commanders had opted to have their scout troops in the lead and their tank companies in reserve. Each troop had 9 tanks and 13 Brads, plus 2 mortar-carrying M113 tracks. In front of them, now 7 kilometers away, were the brigades of UIR 2nd Corps, bloodied by the breakthrough battles north of KKMC, weakened, but probably alert. There was nothing like violent death to get someone's attention. His helicopters and video feed from the Predators had well defined their positions. He knew where they were. They didn't know about him yet. Probably, he had to admit. Certainly they were trying as hard as he would have done to make sure. His final order was for his helicopters to make one more sweep of the intervening terrain for an enemy outpost line. Everything else was pretty well locked into place, and 50 miles back, his Apaches started lifting off, along with their Kiowa scouts, for their part in the main event. The F-15E Strike Eagles were all up north. 2 of their number had been lost earlier in the day, including that of the squadron commander. Now, protected by HARM-equipped F-16s, they were pounding the bridges and causeways across the Twin Rivers estuary with smart bombs. They could see tanks on the ground, burning ones west of the swamps, and intact ones bunched up to the east. In an exciting hour, every route across was destroyed by repeated hits. The F-15Cs were over the KKMC area, as always under AWACS control. One group of 4 stayed high, outside the envelope of the mobile SAMs with the advancing land force. Their job was to watch for UIR fighters who might get in the way of things. The rest were hunting for helicopters belonging to the armored divisions. It didn't carry the prestige of a fighter kill, but a kill was a kill, and something they could do with near total impunity. Better still, generals traveled in helicopters, and most of all, those would be part of the UIR reconnaissance effort. And that, the plan said, couldn't be allowed. Below them, word must have gotten out in a hurry. Only 3 choppers had been killed during the daylight hours, but with the coming of darkness a number had lifted off, 1/2 of them splashed in the first 10 minutes. It was so different from the last time. The hunting was pretty easy. The enemy, on the offense, had to offer battle. Couldn't hide in shelters, couldn't disperse. That suited the Eagle drivers. One driver, south of KKMC, was vectored by his AWACS, located a chopper on his look-down radar, selected AIM 120, and triggered the missile off in seconds. He watched the missile all the way in, spotting the fireball that jerked left and splattered widely on the ground. Part of him thought it a needless waste of a perfectly good slammer, but a kill was a kill. That would be the last chopper kill of the evening. The pilots heard from their E-3B sentry control aircraft that friendly choppers were now entering the battle area, and weapons went tight on the Eagles. Less than 1/2 of his Bradley gunners had ever fired tow missiles for real, though all had done so hundreds of times in simulation. Hoot Owl waited for the advance guard to get just within the margins. It was tricky. The supplementary recon screen was closer still.
The Bradleys engaged them first, and this gunfight was a little more two-sided. Two Burdams were actually behind the American scout line. Both turned at once. One nearly drove over a Humvee, hosing it with its machine gun before a Bradley blew it apart. The armored vehicle raced to the site, finding one wounded survivor from the three-man crew on the Hummer. The infantryman tended to him while the driver got up on a berm and the gunner elevated his tow launcher. The leading group of tanks was shooting now, seeking out the flashes of the Bradley guns, activating their own night vision systems, and again there was a brief, vicious battle over the barren, unlit ground. One Bradley was hit and exploded, killing all aboard. The rest got off one or two missiles each, collecting 20 tanks in reply before their commander called them back, and just escaping the artillery barrage called in by the enemy tank commander on their positions. Hoot Owl left behind that one Bradley and two Hummers and the first American ground casualties of the second Persian Gulf War. These were reported up the line. It was right after lunch in Washington. The president had eaten lightly, and the word came into the Situation Room just after he'd finished, still able to look down at the gold-trimmed plate, the crust of bread from his sandwich, and the chips he'd not eaten. The news of the deaths hit him hard, harder somehow than the casualties on USS Yorktown or the six missing aviators. Missing didn't necessarily mean dead, did it? He allowed himself to think. These men certainly were. National Guardsmen, he'd learned. Citizen soldiers most often used to help people after floods or hurricanes. "Mr. President, would you have gone over there for this mission?" General Moore asked, even before Robbie Jackson could speak. "If you were 20-something again, a Marine lieutenant, and they told you to go, you'd go, right?" "I suppose..." No, I'd go. I'd have to." "So did they, sir," Mickey Moore told him. "That's the job, Jack," Robbie said quietly. "That's what they pay us for." "Yeah." And he had to admit that it was what they paid him for, too. The four F-117 Nighthawks landed at Al-Karj, rolling out and taxiing to shelters. The transports carrying the spare pilots and ground crews were right behind. Intelligence officers down from Riyadh met the latter group, taking the spare pilots aside for their first mission briefing in a war which was just now getting started in a big way. The Major General in charge of the Immortals Division was in his command vehicle trying to make sense of things. It had been a quite satisfactory war to this point. Second Corps had done its job, blasting open the hole, allowing the main force to shoot through. And until an hour before, the picture had been both clear and pleasing. Yes, there were Saudi forces heading southwest for him, but they were the best part of a day away. By then he'd be on the outskirts of their capital, and there were other plans for them as well. At dawn, Second Corps would jump east from its covering position on his left, feinting toward the oil fields. That should give the Saudis second thoughts. Certainly it would give him another day in which, with luck, he'd get some, maybe all of the Saudi government. Maybe even the royal family. Or if they fled, as they might well do, then the kingdom would be leaderless, and then his country would have won the war. It had been costly to this point. Second Corps had paid the price of half its combat power to deliver the army of God this far, but victory had never been cheaply bought. Nor would it be the case here. His forward screen had disappeared right off the radio net. One call of contact with unknown forces, a request for artillery support, then nothing. He knew that a Saudi force was somewhere ahead of him. He knew it was the remains of the 4th Brigade, which Second Corps had almost, but not quite, immolated. He knew it had fought hard north of KKMC and then pulled back. It had probably been ordered to hold so that the city could be evacuated. It was probably still strong enough to chew up his reconnaissance force. He didn't know where the American Cavalry Regiment was. Probably to his east. He knew that there might be another American brigade somewhere, probably also to his east. He wished for helicopters, but he'd just lost one to American fighters, along with his chief intelligence officer. So much for the air support he'd been promised. The only friendly fighter he'd seen all day had been a smoking hole in the ground just east of KKMC.
But though Americans could annoy him, they couldn't stop him. And if he got to Riyadh on time, then he could send troops to cover most of the Saudi airfields and preempt that threat. So the key to the operation, as his corps and army command had told him, was to press on with all possible speed. With that decision made, he ordered his lead brigade to advance as scheduled, with his advance guard playing the reconnaissance role. They'd just reported contact and a battle, losses taken and inflicted on an enemy as yet unidentified, but who had withdrawn after a brief firefight. Probably that Saudi force, he decided, doing its best to sting and run, and he'd run it down after sunrise. He gave the orders, informed his staff of his intentions, and left the command post to drive forward, wanting to see things at the front, as a good general should, while the staff radioed orders to subordinate commanders. There were some screening elements, the Kiowas reported. Not many. They'd probably been badly shot up on the drive south, Colonel Ham thought. He directed one of his squadrons to maneuver left to avoid, and told his air commander to detail an Apache to deal with that one in a few minutes. One of the others could be bypassed easily. The third was directly in the path of Third Squadron, and that was just too bad. The position of the Burdams was marked on the IVUS screens, along with most of UIR's battered Second Corps. So were the Immortals. Eddington saw that the advance guard, with the leading elements of the main force close behind, was just entering gun range of his tanks, advancing at about 20 kilometers per hour. He called Ham.
5 minutes from now. Good luck, Al.
You too, Nick, Eddington heard. It was called synchronicity. 30 miles apart, several groups of Paladin mobile guns elevated their tubes and pointed them to spots picked by Predator drones and Elint intercepts. The cannoneers of the New Age punched the proper coordinates into their computers so that the widely separated weapons could fire to the same point. Eyes were on clocks now, watching the digital numbers change, 1 second at a time, marching toward 22:30 Lima time, 19:30 Zulu, 14:30 Washington. It was much the same in the multiple launch rocket system tracks. There the troops made sure their compartments were sealed, locked their suspension to stabilize the vehicles during the launch cycle, and then closed down windshield shutters. The exhaust from their rockets could be lethal. South of KKMC, the Carolina Guard tankers watched the advancing white blobs. Gunners thumbed their laser rangefinders. The lead screening elements were now 2,500 meters distant, and the follow-on line of the main body 1,000 behind them, mixed tanks and BMPs. Southeast of KKMC, the Black Horse was advancing at 15 kph now, toward a line of targets on a ridge 4,000 meters west. It wasn't perfect. B Troop, 1st of the 11th, stumbled right into an unsuspected Burdam position and opened fire on its own, starting fireballs into the air, turning eyes, and alerting people a few seconds too soon. But in the end, that didn't matter, as the digital numbers kept changing at the same pace, either fast or slow, depending on the perceptions of the onlookers. Eddington timed it to the second. Unable to smoke throughout the evening for fear of making a glow that would show up on somebody's night viewer, he opened his Zippo and flicked it as 59 changed to 00. A little bit of light wouldn't matter. Now. The artillery went first, already ordered to time its fire to the second. The most spectacular were the MLRS rockets, 12 from each launcher, rippling out less than 2 seconds apart, their flaming motors illuminating the exhaust smoke as they streaked into a sky no longer dark. By 22:30:30, nearly 200 of the M-77 free-flight rockets were in the air. By that time, the mobile guns were being reloaded, their lanyards pulled, the guns discharged, and now their breaches open for the next set of rounds. The night was clear, and the light show could not be missed by anyone within 100 miles. Fighter pilots aloft to the northeast saw the rockets fly and looked closely at their course. They didn't want to be in the same sky with the things. Iraqi officers in the advancing Guards Armored Division saw them first, coming up from the south, and next they saw that all were angling west of the north-south road from KKMC to Al-Artawiya. Many of them had seen the same sight as lieutenants and captains, and knew exactly what they meant. Steel rain was coming. Some were paralyzed by the sight. Others shouted orders for men to get cover, close their hatches, and ride it out. That wasn't possible for the divisional artillerymen. Most of their guns were towed, and most of the gunners were in the open, ammunition trucks standing by for the fire mission that had to be coming. They saw the rocket motors burn out, noted their direction, and there was little to be done but wait. Men dived to the ground, usually scattering first, holding their helmets in place and praying that the damn things were heading somewhere else. The rockets tipped over on Apogee, heading back to the ground. At several thousand feet, a timer blew open the noses, and each projectile released 644 submunitions, each weighing half a pound, which made for 7,728 for each of the launchers employed. All were targeted at the Guards Division's artillery. That was their longest-reaching weapon, and Eddington wanted it out of play immediately. As was the practice in the U.S. Army, MLRS was the unit commander's personal shotgun. A few of the Iraqi gunners looked up. They couldn't see or hear them coming, but come they did. From a distance it looked like sparklers on the ground, or maybe firecrackers at Chinese New Year, dancing and exploding in celebration. It was noisy death for those on the ground, as a total of over 70,000 of the munitions exploded over an area of about 200 acres. Trucks caught fire and exploded in flame. Propellant charges lit off in secondary explosions, but most of all the artillerymen were slaughtered, over 80% of them killed or wounded by the first volley. There would be two more. Back of Wolfpack Center, the launch vehicles scuttled back to their resupply trucks. Just before getting there, the expended six-pack launch cells were ejected, and new ones hoisted into place with rigging equipment. It took about 5 minutes to accomplish the reload. It was faster for the 155mm guns. These, too, were gunning for their enemy counterparts, and their rounds were every bit as accurate as the rockets. It was the most mechanistic of military activities. The gun did the killing, and the people served the gun. They couldn't see their work, and in this case didn't even have a forward observer to tell them how they were doing. But they'd learned that with GPS doing the aiming, it didn't matter. And if things went as planned, they would later see the results of their deadly work. Perversely, those with direct views of the advancing enemy fired last, the tankers waiting for the word, delivered as company commanders fired first for their units. For all its lethality, the fire control system for the Abrams tank is one of the simplest mechanisms ever placed in the hands of soldiers, and even easier to use than the million-dollar crew training simulators. The gunners each had assigned sectors, and the initial rounds fired by the company commanders had been HEAT, high explosive anti-tank rounds, which made a distinctive visual signature. Tanks were assigned areas left or right of those first kills. The thermal imaging viewing systems keyed on heat, infrared radiation. Their targets were warmer than the desert landscape at night and announced their presence as clearly as light bulbs. Each gunner was told what area to pick from, and each selected an advancing T-80. Centering the target in the sight, the laser buttons were depressed. The beam went out to the target and reflected back. The return signal told the ballistic computer the target's distance, speed, and direction of movement. Other sensors told it the outside temperature, the temperature of the ammunition, atmospheric density, wind direction and speed, the condition of the gun, hot ones droop, and how many shells had been fired through the tube to this point in its career. The computer digested this and other information, processed it, and when finished, flashed a white rectangle in the gun sight to tell the gunner the system was on target.
Then it was just a matter of his closing his index finger on the yoke's twin triggers. The tank lurched. The breech surged back. The muzzle flash blinded the sight momentarily, and the sabot rounds streaked downrange at more than a mile a second. The projectiles were like overly thick arrows, less than the length of a man's arm, and 2 inches in diameter, with stubby fins on the tail that burned from air friction in their brief flight, and trailing tracers for the tank commander to watch the silver bullets all the way in. The targets were Russian-made T-80s, old tanks with old design histories. They were much smaller than their American adversaries, mainly due to their inadequate engine power, and their diminished size had made for a number of design compromises. There was a fuel tank in the front, the line for which went along the turret ring. Gun rounds were fitted in slots that nested in the rear fuel tank, so that their ammunition was surrounded by diesel fuel. Finally, to save on turret space, the loader had been replaced by an automated loading system, which, in addition to being slower than a man, also required that a live round be in the open in the turret at all times. It might not have made all that much of a difference in any case, but it did make for spectacular kills. The second T-80 to die took a silver bullet at the base of the turret. The incoming round obliterated the fuel line first of all, and in the process of crashing through the armor, created a lethal shower of fragments moving at over 1,000 meters per second in the cramped confines, caroming off the inner surface and chopping the crewmen to bits. At the same time, the ready round ignited on its tray and other rounds exploded in their racks. The crew was already dead when the ammunition exploded, also setting off the fuel and creating an explosion which blew the heavy turret 50 feet straight up in what the Army called a catastrophic kill. 15 others died the same way in the space of 3 seconds. The Immortals Division's advance guard evaporated in 10 more, and the only resistance they were able to offer was that the pyres of their vehicles obscured the battlefield. Fire shifted at once to the main body, 3 battalions advancing on line, now just over 3,000 meters away, a total of just over 150 advancing toward a battalion of 54. The commanders of the Iranian tanks were mainly still out of their turrets, the better to see, despite their having seen the rockets lifting off several miles downrange. They next saw a linear ripple of white and orange 3 kilometers in the distance, followed by explosions to their direct front. The quicker of the officers and conscripted tank commanders ordered their gunners to get rounds off at the muzzle flashes, and no less than 10 did shoot, but they hadn't had time to gauge the range, and all their rounds fell short. The Iranian crews were drilled in what to do, and they hadn't as yet had time for fear to replace shock. Some started reload cycles, while others worked their range finders to get off properly aimed rounds. But then the horizon turned orange again, and what followed scarcely gave them the time to take note of the change of color in the sky. The next volley of 54 main gun rounds found 44 marks, then of the T-80s being double-targeted. This was less than 20 seconds into the engagement. "Find one still moving," 1E6 tank commander said to his gunner. The battlefield was lighting up now, and the fireballs interfered with the thermal viewers. "There." The gunner got his laser range, 3,650 meters. The box came up, and he fired. The sights blanked, then came back, and he could see the tracer of his round arcing flat across the desert all the way in. "Target," the commander said. "Shift fire." "Identified. Got one." "Fire," the commander ordered. On the way, the gunner fired his 3rd round of the half-minute, and 3 seconds later, another T-80 turret became a ballistic object. Just that fast, the tank phase of the battle was over. The Bradleys were engaging the advancing BMPs, their Bushmaster cannons reaching out. It was slower for them, the range more difficult for their lighter guns, but the result was just as final. The commander of the Immortals was just approaching the trail elements of the lead brigade when he saw the rockets fly. Telling his driver to pull over, he stood and turned in his command vehicle and saw the secondary explosions of his divisional artillery array. When, turning back forward, he saw the 2nd volley of Eddington's tanks. 40% of his combat power had disappeared in less than a minute. Even before the shock hit him, he knew that he'd walked into an ambush. But of what? The MLRS, or Miller's rockets, which had robbed the Immortals of their artillery, had come from the east, not the south. It was Ham's gift to the National Guardsmen, who were unable to go after the Iranian guns themselves with the existing fire plan. Black Horse's Millers had done that, then shifted fire to make way for the regiment's Apache attack helicopters, which were striking deep, actually beyond the 2nd Corps units now being engaged by the 3 ground squadrons. The division of labor on this battlefield had been determined in principle the previous day, and developments had not changed anyone's thoughts. Artillery would initially target artillery. Tanks would target tanks. The helicopters were out to kill commanders. The Immortals Division CP had stopped 20 minutes earlier. 10 minutes before the first rocket launch, Apache Kiowa teams looped around from the north, approaching from the rear and heading for the places from which the radio signals were emitting. First would come the division-level targets, followed by the brigades. The Immortals staff was just coming to terms with the incoming signals. Some officers requested confirmation or clarification, information needed before they could react properly to the situation. That was the problem with command posts. They were the institutional brains of the units they commanded, and the people who made up the decision process had to be together to function. From 6 kilometers away, the collection of vehicles was obvious. 4 SAM shooters were oriented south, and there was a ring of AAA guns, too. Those went first. The Apaches of P attack troop stopped in place, picking a spot with nothing dangerous around and hovering at about 100 feet. Front-seated gunners, all of them young warrant officers, used optical equipment to zoom in, selected the first group of targets, and selected Hellfire laser-guided missiles. The first launch was made by surprise, but an Iranian soldier saw the flash and shouted to a gun crew, which slewed its guns around and started shooting before the missiles were all the way on. What followed was a madhouse. The targeted Apache dodged left, accelerating sideways at 50 knots to throw them off, but also ruining the aim of the startled gunner, who had to shoot again, as the first missile went wide. The other AH-64s were not hampered, and of their 6 launches, 5 hit. In another minute, the anti-air problem was neutralized, and the attack choppers closed. They could see people running now, out and away from the command tracks. Some soldiers in the command security group started firing their rifles into the sky, and there was more structured activity from machine gunners, but surprise was on the other side. The gunners fired 2.75-inch rockets to blanket the area, hellfires to eliminate the few remaining armored vehicles, and then shifted to their 30-millimeter cannon. In display of their rage, they closed in now, like the oversized insects they appeared to be, buzzing and slipping from side to side while the gunners looked for people the heavier weapons had missed. There was no place to hide on the flat terrain, and the human bodies glowed on the dark, colder surface, and the gunners hunted them down in groups, in pairs, and finally one by one, sweeping across the site like harvesters. In their pre-mission discussion on the flight line, it had been decided that, unlike in 1991, helicopters would not accept surrender in this war, and the 30-millimeter projectiles had explosive tips. P-Troop, they called themselves the Predators, lingered for 10 minutes before they were satisfied that every single vehicle was destroyed and every moving body dead before they twisted in the sky, dipped their noses, and headed back east for their rearm points. The premature attack on 2nd Corps' reconnaissance element had started one part of this battle a little too early, and alerted a reasonably intact tank company sooner than intended. But the enemy tanks were still white blobs on a black background and less than 4,000 meters away. "Battle stars engage," B-Troop's commander ordered, firing off his first round, soon to be followed by 8 more. 6 hit, even at this extreme range, and the attack by the Black Horse on 2nd Corps began even before the first Miller's volley. The next volley was delivered on the move, and 5 more tanks exploded, their return rounds falling short. It was a little harder to hit this way. Though the gun was stabilized, hitting a bump could throw the aim off, and misses were expected, if not exactly welcomed. B-Troop's tanks were spaced fully 0.5 kilometer apart, and each had a hunting zone exactly that wide, and the farther they went, the more targets appeared. The Bradley scout vehicles hung back 100 yards or so, and their gunners looked for infantry who might wield anti-tank weapons. Second Corps' two divisions were spread across 20 miles of linear space and about 8 miles of depth, so said the Ivis gear. In 10 minutes, B Troop chopped its way through a battalion diminished by the Saudis and now erased by the Americans. The bonus came 10 minutes later when they spotted a battery of artillery setting up. The Bradleys got those, sweeping the area with their 25-millimeter cannon and adding to the fireballs that gave the lie to the sunset only 4 hours old.
Damn.
Eddington merely spoke the word without any emphasis at all. He had been called forward by his battalion commanders and was now standing up in his Humvee.
"You believe less than 5 minutes?" Lobo Six asked.
He'd heard the amazement himself over his battalion net.
"Is that all?"
More than one sergeant had asked aloud. It was crummy radio discipline, but everyone was thinking the same thing. But there was more to do than admire the work. Eddington lifted his radio handset and called for his Brigade S2.
"What's Predator tell us?"
"We have two more brigades still southbound, but they're slowed some, sir. They're roughly 9 clicks north of your line on the near one and 12 on the far one."
"Put me through to Buford," Wolfpack Six ordered.
The general was still in the same place, with death before and behind. Scarcely 10 minutes had passed. 3 tanks and 12 BMPs had run backward, stopping at a depression and holding position while they waited for instructions. There were men coming back now, too, some wounded, most not. He could not scream at them. If anything, the shock of the moment was harder on him than it was on them. He'd already tried contacting his divisional command post, but gotten only static in return. And for all his experience in uniform, his time in command, the schools he'd attended, and the exercises he'd won and lost, nothing had prepared him for this. But he still had more than half a division to command. 2 of his brigades were still fully intact, and he hadn't come here to lose. He ordered his driver to turn and head back. To the surviving elements of the lead brigade went orders to hold until further word. He had to maneuver. He'd run into a nightmare, but it couldn't be everywhere.
"What do you propose, Eddington?"
"General Diggs, I want to move my people north. We just ate up 2 tank brigades easier than a plate full of grits. The enemy's artillery is largely destroyed, sir, and I have a clear field in front of me."
"Okay, take your time and watch your flanks. I'll notify Black Horse."
"Roger that, sir. We'll be moving in 20.
They'd thought about this possibility, of course. There was even a sketch plan on the maps. Lobo would shift and extend right. White Fang would go straight north, straddling the road, and the so far unengaged Battalion Task Force Coyote would take the left, echeloned to be able to sweep in from the rough terrain to the west. From their new positions, the brigade would grind north to phase lines spaced 10 kilometers apart. They'd have to move slowly because of the darkness, the unfamiliar ground, and the fact that it was only half a plan. But the activation code word was Nathan, and the first phase line was Manassas. Eddington hoped Diggs wouldn't mind.
"This is Wolfpack 6 to all sixes. Code word is Nathan. I repeat, we are activating Plan Nathan in 20 minutes. Acknowledge," he ordered.
All 3 battalion commanders chimed in seconds later. Diggs had kept him in the loop, and the picture, such as it was up on the command screen in the M4 God track. Colonel Magruder wasn't all that surprised at the initial results, except maybe that the guardsmen had done so well. Rather more surprising was the progress the 10th had made. Advancing at a steady 30 kilometers per hour, he was well into the former Iraq and ready to turn south. This he did at 0200 Lima. His helicopter squadron left behind to cover the Kuwaitis. He felt a little naked at the moment, but it was still dark and would be for another 4 hours. By then he'd be back in Saudi. Buffalo 6 judged that he had the best cavalry mission of all. Here he was, deep into enemy territory, and deeper still in his rear. Just like what Colonel John Grierson had done to Johnny Reb, and what he and the Buffalo soldiers had done to the Apaches. He ordered his units to spread wide. Reconnaissance said there wasn't much out here to get in the way, that the enemy's main strength was deep in the kingdom. Well, he didn't think it would get much deeper,
and all he had to do was slam the door behind.
Donner was standing up in the top hatch of the scout track, behind the turret, with his army cameraman next to him. It was like nothing he'd ever seen. He'd gotten the assault on the gun battery on tape, though he didn't think the tape would be all that usable, what with all the bouncing and bumping. All around him was destruction. Behind, to the southeast, were at least 100 burned-out tanks, trucks, and other things he didn't recognize. And it had all happened in less than an hour. He lurched forward, striking his face on the hatch rim when the Bradley stopped.
"Get security out!" the track commander shouted. "We're going to be here for a bit."
The Bradleys were arrayed in a circle about a mile north of the wrecked UIR guns. There was nothing moving around them, which the gunner made sure of by traversing his turret around. The rear hatch opened, and two men jumped out, first looking and then running, rifles in hand.
"Come here," the sergeant said, holding his hand out.
Donner took it and climbed to the vehicle's roof.
"Want a smoke?"
Donner shook his head.
"Gave it up."
"Yeah, well, those folks'll stop smoking in a day or two," he said, gesturing to the mess a mile back. The sergeant thought that was a pretty good one. He lifted binoculars to his eyes and looked around, confirming what the gun sights said.
"What do you think of this?" the reporter asked, tapping his cameraman.
"I think this is what they pay me for, and it all works."
"What are we stopped for?"
"We'll get some fuel in half an hour, and we need to replenish ammo." He put the glasses down.
"We need fuel? We haven't been moving that much."
"Well, the colonel thinks tomorrow might be kind of busy, too."
He turned.
"What do you think, Tom?"
Chapter 62. Ready and Forward. What people call the initiative, whether in war or any other field of human activity, is never anything more or less than a psychological advantage. It combines one side's feeling that they are winning with the other side's feeling that something has gone wrong, that they must now prepare for and respond to the actions of their enemy instead of preparing their own offensive action. Couched in terms of momentum or ascendancy, it really always comes down to who is doing what to whom. And a sudden change in that equation will have a stronger effect than that of a gradual build-up to the same set of circumstances. The expected, when replaced by the unexpected, lingers for a time, lingers in the mind, since it is easier, for a while, to deny rather than to adapt. And that just makes things harder for those who are being done too. For the doers, there are other tasks. For the American forces in contact, there came a brief, unwelcome but necessary pause. It should have been easiest of all for Colonel Nick Eddington of Wolfpack, but it wasn't. His force of National Guard troops had done little more than stay in place for their first battle, which had allowed the enemy to come into their kill box, an ambush 15 miles wide by 15 deep. Except for the brigade's reconnaissance screen, the men from Carolina had hardly moved at all. But now that had to change, and Eddington was reminded of the fact that though he was, after a fashion, a ballet master, the things performing the maneuvering were tanks, ponderous and clumsy, moving in the dark across unfamiliar ground. Technology helped. He had radios to tell his people when and where to go, and the IVUS system to tell them how. Task Force Lobo started by backing off the reverse slope positions that had served them so well only 40 minutes earlier, turning south and heading through pre-selected navigational waypoints to destinations less than 10 kilometers south of their initial fighting positions. In the process, the augmented battalion diluted itself, spread itself more thinly than it had been, a feat made possible because the battalion staff was able to program the move electronically and transmit their intentions to subunit commanders, who, assigned areas of responsibility, were able to subdivide them almost automatically, until every single vehicle knew its destination to the meter. The initial delay of 20 minutes from notification that Plan Nathan was about to be activated allowed that selection process to begin. The lateral shift required an hour, with the vehicles moving across what appeared to be vacant land at the speed of commuters in a particularly congested rush hour. Even so, it worked, and an hour from the time the movement was started, it had been completed. Wolfpack,
now covering well over 20 miles of lateral space, wheeled, turned north, and started moving out at 10 kilometers per hour, with recon teams darting forward faster still to take position 5 clicks in advance of the main body. That was well short of what the book said the interval should be. Eddington had to be mindful of the fact that he was maneuvering a large force of part-time soldiers whose dependence on their electronic technology was a little too great for his total comfort. He'd keep his force of 3 fighting battalions under tight control until contact was established and the overall picture was clear. It surprised Tom Donner that the support vehicles, nearly all of them robust-looking trucks, were able to follow the fighting units as quickly as they did. Somehow he hadn't understood how important this was, accustomed as he was to hitting one particular gas station once or twice a week. Here the service personnel had to be as mobile as their customers, and that, he realized, was a major task. The fuel trucks set up. The Bradleys and battle tanks came to them 2 at a time, then went back to their perimeter posts, where ammunition was dropped off other trucks for the track crewmen to load up. Every Bradley, he learned, had a Sears socket wrench, in nearly every case bought out of the gunner's salary, to facilitate reloading of the Bushmaster magazine. It worked better than the tool designed for the purpose. That was probably worth a little story, he thought with a distant smile. The troop commander, now in his command Humvee instead of his M1A2, raced about from track to track to ascertain the condition of each vehicle and crew. He saved 3-2 for the last. "Mr. Donner, you doing okay, sir?" The reporter sipped at coffee brewed up by the Bradley's driver and nodded. "Is it always like this?" he asked the young officer. "First time for me, sir. Pretty much like training, though." "What do you think about all this?" the journalist asked. "I mean, back there, you and your people, well, killed a lot of the enemy." The captain thought about that briefly. "Sir, you ever cover tornadoes and hurricanes and stuff?"
"Yes."
"And people get their lives all messed up, and you ask them what it's like, right?"
"That's my job."
"Same with us. These guys made war on us. We're making war back. If they don't like it, well, maybe next time they'll think more about it." "Sir, I got an uncle in Texas. Uncle and an aunt, actually. Used to be a golf pro. He taught me how to play, then went to work for Cobra. The club company, okay? Right before we left Fort Irwin, my mom called and told me they both died of that Ebola shit, sir." "You really want to know what we think of this?" asked an officer who'd killed 5 tanks this night. "Saddle up, Mr. Donner. The Black Horse will be rolling in 10. You can expect contact right before dawn, sir." There was a dull flash on the horizon, followed a minute or so later by the rumble of distant thunder. "I guess the Apaches are starting early." 15 miles to the northwest, 2nd Corps' command post had just been destroyed. The plan was evolving. 1st Squadron would pivot and drive north through remaining 2nd Corps units. 3rd Squadron would come south through lighter opposition, massing the regiment for the first attack into the enemy 3rd Corps' left flank. 10 miles away, Ham was moving his artillery to facilitate the destruction of the remains of 2nd Corps, whose commanders his helicopter squadron had just eliminated. Eddington reminded himself again that he had to keep it simple. Despite all his years of study and the name he'd assigned to his counterstroke, he wasn't Nathan Bedford Forrest, and this battlefield wasn't small enough for him to ad-lib his maneuvers, as that racist genius had done so often in the War of the Northern Aggression. Hood Owl was spread especially thin now, with the brigade's front almost doubled in the last 90 minutes, and that was slowing them down. Probably not a bad thing, the colonel thought. He had to be patient. The enemy force couldn't maneuver too far east for fear of running into the left of Black Horse, assuming they knew it was there, he thought, and the ground to the west was too choppy to allow easy movement. They'd tried the middle and gotten pounded for it. So the logical move for the enemy 1st Corps was to try a limited envelopment maneuver, probably weighted to the east. Incoming pictures from the Predator drones started to confirm that. The commander of the Immortals no longer had a proper command post to use, and so he absorbed what was left of the command post from the vanished 1st Brigade, having also learned that he had to keep moving at all times. The first order of business for him had been to re-establish contact with 1st Corps Command, which had proved somewhat difficult, as the CP had been on the move when he'd walked into the American, it had to be American, ambush along the road to Al-Artawiya. Now 1st Corps was setting up again and probably talking a lot to Army Command. He broke in, got the 3-star, a fellow Iranian, and told what he could as rapidly as possible.
"There cannot be more than a single brigade," his immediate superior assured him. "What will you do?"
"I shall mass my remaining forces and strike from both flanks before dawn," the divisional commander replied. It wasn't as though he had much choice in the matter, and both senior officers knew it. 1st Corps couldn't retreat, because the government which had ordered it to march would not countenance that. Staying still meant waiting for the Saudi forces storming down from the Kuwaiti border. The task, then, was to regain the initiative by overpowering the American blocking force by maneuver and shock effect. That was what tanks were designed to do, and he had more than 400 still under his command.
"Approved. I will dispatch you my corps artillery. Guards armored on your right will do the same. Accomplish your breakthrough," his fellow Iranian told him. "Then we will drive to Riyadh by dusk."
Very well, the Immortals commander thought. He ordered his 2nd Brigade to slow its advance, allowing 3rd to catch up, concentrate, and maneuver east. To his west, the Iraqis would be doing much the same in mirror image. 2nd would advance to contact, fix the enemy flank, and 3rd would sweep around, taking them in the rear. The center he would leave empty.
"They've stopped. The lead brigade has stopped. They're 8 clicks north," the brigade S2 said. "Hoot should have visual on them in a few minutes to confirm." That explained what one of the enemy forces to his front was doing. The western group was somewhat farther back, not stopped, but moving slowly forward, evidently waiting for orders or some change in their dispositions. His opponent and his people were taking time to think. Eddington couldn't allow that. The only real problem with Miller's was that it had minimum range far less convenient than the maximum. For the 2nd mission that night, the rocket vehicles, which hadn't really moved at all, locked their suspensions in place and elevated their launcher boxes, again aimed by electronic information only. Again the night was disturbed by the streaks of rocket trails, though this time on much lower trajectories. Tube artillery did the same, with both forces dividing their attention between the advance brigades left and right of the highway. The purpose was more psychological than real. The mini-bomblets of the Miller's rockets would not kill a tank. A lucky fall atop a rear deck might disable a diesel engine, and the sides of the BMP infantry carriers could sometimes be penetrated by a nearby detonation. But these were chance events. The real effect was to make the enemy button up, to limit their ability to see, and with the falling steel rain limit their ability to think. Officers who'd leaped from their command tanks to confer had to run back, some of them killed or wounded by the sudden barrage. Sitting safely in stationary vehicles, they heard the ping sound of fragments bounding off their armor, and peered out their vision systems to see if the artillery barrage presaged a proper attack. The less numerous 155mm artillery rounds were a greater danger, all the more so since the American gun rounds were not bursting in the air, but were common shells that hit the ground first. The laws of probability guaranteed that some of the vehicles would be hit, and some were, erupting into fireballs as the rest of 2nd Brigade was forced to hold in place, ordered to do so while 3rd moved up to their left. Unable to move and, with the loss of their own divisional artillery, unable to respond in kind, they could do nothing but cringe and stay alert, look out of their vehicles, and watch the shells and bomblets fall. B Troop, 1st of the 11th, moved out on schedule, spreading out and traveling due north, with the Bradley scouts in the lead and the Battlestar tanks half a click behind, ready to respond to a report of contact. It provided a strange revelation to Donner. An intelligent man, and even an outdoorsman of sorts who enjoyed backpacking with his family on the Appalachian Trail,
He spent as much time as he could looking out of the Bradley, and didn't have a clue as to what was really going on. He finally overcame his embarrassment and got on the interphones to ask the track commander how he knew, and was called forward, where he crammed himself as a third man in a space designed for two. More like one and a half, the reporter thought. "We're here," the staff sergeant told him, touching his finger to the IVA screen. "We're going that way. According to this, there's nobody around to bother us, but we're looking out for that. The enemy," he changed the display somewhat, "is here, and we're along this line."
"How far?"
"About 12 clicks, and we should start to see him."
"How good is this information?" Donner asked.
"It got us this far, Tom," the track commander pointed out. The pattern of movement was annoying, and reminded the reporter of stop-and-go traffic on a Friday afternoon. The armored vehicles would dart, never faster than 20 miles per hour, from one terrain feature to another, scan ahead, then move some more. The sergeant explained that they'd move in a steadier manner on better ground, but that this part of the Saudi desert was marked by hillocks and ridges and dips that people might hide behind. The Brads were in a platoon, but actually seemed to move in pairs. Every M3 had a wingman, a term borrowed from the Air Force.
"What if there's somebody out there?"
"Then he'll probably try to shoot at us," the staff sergeant explained. All this time the gunner was traversing his turret left and right, searching for the glow of a warm body on the chilled ground. They could actually see better at night, Donner learned, which was why Americans had adopted the darkness as their preferred hunting time. "Stanley, come left and stop behind that bump," he ordered the driver. "If I was a grunt, I'd like that place over to the right. We'll cover Chuck as he comes around it." The turret rotated and sighted in on a larger bump, while the Bradley's wingman drove past. "Okay, Stanley, move out." The Army of God command section had proved devilishly hard to pin down, but now Ham had two Hilo Scout troops detailed to that single mission, and his electronic intelligence section had just set up again, co-located with 2nd Squadron's headquarters group. They'd taken to calling their target the Enchilada, locate it, and disorganize the entire enemy force. Saudi intelligence officers attached to the Elint tracks were listening to signals. The UIR forces had encrypted radios for the senior commanders, but those were good only for talking to other people with the same equipment. And with the gradual degradation of the enemy radio network, sooner or later the Enchilada would have to start talking in the clear. 1st Corps and 2 divisional command posts had been hit, 2 of those almost totally destroyed and the other badly disrupted. Moreover, they knew roughly where 3rd Corps was, and Army would have to start talking to that formation, since it was the only one so far not engaged except by a few airstrikes. They didn't have to read the messages, nice though that would have been. They knew the frequency ranges for the high command circuit, and a few minutes of traffic would enable them to localize it enough for M and N helicopter scout troops to dart in and start ruining their whole morning. It sounded like static, but digitally encrypted radios usually did. The Elint officer, a first lieutenant, loved eavesdropping, but missed his jamming gear, which had been overlooked in the POMCAS equipment sets, probably, he thought, because that was supposed to be an Air Force mission. There was an art to this. His troopers, all military intelligence specialists, had to tell the difference between real atmospheric static and man-made static as they swept the frequencies. "Bingo," one said. "Bearing 305, hissing like a snake." It was too loud to be atmospheric noise, random though it might have sounded.
"How good?" the officer asked.
90%, LT. A second vehicle, slaved electronically to the first, was a click away, providing a baseline for triangulation. "There." The location came up on the computer screen. The lieutenant lifted a radio for the 4th Squadron command post. "Angel 6, this is Peeper. We may have a posit for the Enchilada." M troops, 4 Apaches and 6 Kiowas were but 20 clicks away from the position, conducting a visual search. A minute later, they turned south.
"What is happening?" Mahmoud Haji demanded.
He hated using this phone radio lash-up,
and just getting in contact with his own army commander had proved difficult enough. "We have encountered opposition south of King Khalid Military City. We are dealing with it."
"Ask him the nature of the opposition," intelligence advised his leader.
"Perhaps your guest could tell me that," the general on the other side of the conversation suggested. "We're still working to find out."
"The Americans cannot have more."